said, "We'll have to send her selfies. Now, let's go get Turnt." And Turnt we got. And by that, I mean these girls were jet-lagged, and after a snail's crawl through San Francisco traffic to our adorable Sonoma Inn, we Turnt our sleepy selves into our hotel beds. Ash, Lindsay, and I were splitting one room, and the other four gals split another. Not that I wouldn't have shared a room with girls I had only hung out with once before. I mean, I've shared rooms with people I've known for three drinks, you know. But I just needed to be near my old school girls. The girls I'd ride around with looking for boys, all while blasting Juvenile's Back That Ass Up from our shitty Honda speakers. "Aw, you guys," I said, getting into bed with Ash. "When's the last time the three of us slept in one room together?" "My God, probably 2001 at your house," Ash chimed in from below the duvet. "Except now we aren't sleeping on a pallet on your floor, and your sister isn't trying to secretly get us high when you aren't watching." It was true. While I was infamous in high school for maintaining a squeaky clean track record of not smoking weed, my sister was infamous for getting people to try smoking weed for the first time. She was like the Mrs. Robinson of great flavored blunts. I snuggled under those blankets, totally content. It was like old times. Just a few minutes later, I conked out, dreaming of all the wine we'd drink the next day. The following morning, after slapping on some makeup and, of course, our rompers and hats, we met up with the rest of the girls at the lobby's continental breakfast. Everyone was carbo-loading, like calories just magically didn't exist in Northern California. I'm talking toast, waffles, cereal, danishes, all the perfect foundational elements for day drinking. However, I myself abstained, as I'm not much of a breakfast person. I prefer to drink coffee until I don't know whether I have the shakes or if an earthquake is happening. And living in California, that happens pretty often. But skipping breakfast wasn't just out of habit. It was strategy. After all, I can drink. Not saying these women weren't capable of putting back a 12-pack at a college tailgate, but drinking is essentially my profession. I start feeling it after a bottle of wine. Let it be known that I am not proud of this, nor do I think this is a good thing. Do you know how much money and time and calories I would save if I could get buzzed off a glass of Pinot Grigio like a normal-sized woman my height and weight? My stature might say average-sized female, but my tolerance is that of Fat Bastard from Austin Powers. Skipping the waffles would hopefully let me start feeling the wine on the same schedule as everyone else. We piled into the limo and headed to the first vineyard, drinking mimosas along the way. It felt like we were headed to a very classy prom, unlike the ones us Yadkin County gals had attended in a badly carpeted conference room at the Comfort Inn off exit 82. But this time, we weren't headed to a hotel that shared a parking lot with a Cracker Barrel. We were headed to classy establishments with barrels of wine and crackers to cleanse the palate. We rolled into the first tasting room, excited for what the morning held. The room was gorgeous, with exposed wooden beams and lots of stone. Seeing as though it was all of 10 a.m. and Ash had scheduled to have a private tasting with the sommelier, we were the only ones there. "Today we'll be diving into a variety of whites and reds," said the mustachioed sommelier. "We'll call him Som," as he poured everyone a dollop of Cabernet. "You'll notice the first one we are tasting is very dry," we all nodded, "with strong notes of black cherry and even a little tobacco." No thanks, I quit years ago," I said while exaggeratingly sniffing my wine. The girls all laughed. I knew this was because they were already buzzed from the road mimosas, but I didn't care. A captive audience is a captive audience. Som continued describing the wine, only pausing to swat away a fly every few seconds. We watched him trying to keep his composure while talking about the subtle bouquets and tannins, but this fly was circling him like he was Pigpen from Peanuts. By the third wine, Som's face was redder than the Pinot we were about to taste. "This damn fly! It has been pestering me for days!" "Well, it looks like you literally caught a buzz," I said, buzzing like a fly to really send the pun home. Laughs all around. I was on fire. This was my Apollo audience, and based on Som's unenthused expression, he wanted to be the Sandman and straight up shepherd's hook my ass off stage. "I wish I could catch that buzz," Som said while opening another bottle of wine. "I tell you what, if one of you catches that fly, I'll give you a free bottle of any of the wines we're tasting," he said, with a little laugh in his voice until he realized what he had just done. You gotta remember, this was a group of girls who grew up in the country. Not only do we love free shit, but everyone in that room had dated someone in high school who had hunted, if they themselves didn't hunt. So Sam continued describing the wines, and we kept sipping and nodding, all while keeping the fly in our peripherals. Now, for our first white is a steel cast Chardonnay that thwap! Everyone looked over to Ashley, whose hand was suction cupped over her tasting glass. Underneath was the fly. You did it! I exclaimed, as if she had just wrangled a wild tiger with her bare hands. I think I'll catch and release, she said, slowly standing up and making her way to the door. With great flair, she released the beast as we all applauded. I will take a bottle of the Pinot Noir, kind sir, she said, curtsying and plopping back on the corner couch proudly. Unless you were joking. I'm sorry, were you joking? Classic Ashley. So nice that even though she trapped the fly like a boss, she wasn't going to make the man pay up. A deal's a deal. Now, as I was saying, this Chardonnay is extra special because at first you'll taste the crisp honeysuckle flavors, but let it rest on your tongue for a moment and notes of green bell pepper will start to emerge. We all sipped and oohed and aahed as if we could taste anything this man was talking about. He was halfway through describing what stones we were supposed to taste on the back notes when, don't you know it, that fly was back at it! The poor guy was trying his best to block out the buzzing and continue on with the presentation as it hovered around us. As he started pouring our sixth and final wine, the buzzing stopped, and the fly was out of sight. It was finally silent. That is, until I started giggling. I couldn't help it. Something was lightly tickling my foot. I looked down, and the fly was perched right on top of my strappy sandal. Nobody move, I said to the gals, who were definitely not planning on moving anytime soon. I got him. I looked up to Sam, who froze so perfectly that if wine didn't work out, he could totally be one of those street performers who paint themselves gold. If I can get this fly out of here, do I get a free bottle of wine too? I asked, hope glimmering in my eyes. I guess, he started to say, and that's all I needed to hear. I rose to my feet with the precision and balance of a tightrope walker, and for the next 3 minutes, I took the world's tiniest steps, inch by inch, making my way to the door. And this was harder than it sounds, seeing as I was wheezing laughing. The combination of morning drinking, while admitting my feet were so gross that they were a goddamn Golden Corral buffet for this sucker, was too much to handle. There's a picture attached where you can see the exact moment I was ushering this tiny fly out the door. I basically looked like the documentary Man on a Wire, except I was bitch on a budget. I finally got to the doorframe, looked at the captivated group, and said, are you ready for this? Talk about shoe fly. Don't bother me. Kung fu kicking the fly into the outside heat. Guys, when I say this joke killed, I mean it. I almost retired right there, but instead I graciously took my hard-earned bottle from Sam, and we continued on our journey. For the rest of the afternoon, we cruised around to other vineyards, doing our tastings, having a glass on their grounds, and then drinking whatever we bought when we got back in the limo. It was a top-to-bottom afternoon of laughing and cutting up and telling various gorgeous women in their early 20s who worked at the vineyards that we were jealous of them and that they had luminous skin. It was a perfect day, but I could tell that Ash was a little distracted. She was smiling and joking, but when you've been someone's best friend for 17 years, you just know. But I wasn't about to confront her about it in the back of this stretch limo in front of everyone. This wasn't Vanderpump Rules. By the time we were dropped back at the inn, the whole gang seemed a little tired and a little cranky. I looked over to Lindsay, who was rubbing her eyes like a toddler, and knew we all needed to be put down for a nap. Let's all meet back up in the lobby at 7 and go to dinner. Is that cool with everyone? Ashley asked, the ever-consistent sweet mom of the group. We all nodded our sleepy heads and split off to our rooms for some hardcore napping. The kind of napping where you instantly start dreaming, and when you wake up, you freak out for a second that you slept until the next day. Luckily, I had set an alarm. Nothing like waking up at 6 p.m. already slightly hungover to know you did wine country right. Only thing to do now was power through and keep the party going. I rallied the girls and we sleepily fixed our makeup and put our hats back on to hide our bedhead. We headed to the lobby to meet everyone else before Lindsay was stopped in her tracks. Holy hell, come look at this. Ash and I reversed it to meet her in front of a room with its door wide open. Inside was the rest of the crew, totally knocked out. One of the girls, face down like the dead man's float, with her dress shimmied up so high, her ass was on display for anyone walking by to see. It was Haley on the Cove Haven bed all over again. "Aw, bless their hearts," Ashley said. "I feel bad waking them." "Me too," I said. "Let's let them sleep and go catch up just the three of us." They nodded as I crept inside to pull down the dress and cover the exposed booty. Then we turned off their light and gently shut the door. We took a quick Uber ride to the main Sonoma Square, stomachs rumbling. All the restaurants were packed, so we did what anyone would do. We put our name on the list at a Mexican place, then sat at the bar drinking margs and filling up on chips and salsa to the point where we would eventually be too full when they finally called our name, also known as the most annoying thing you can do at a restaurant. We weren't two margs in before I looked over at Ash and saw she had tears welling up in her eyes. Oh, please don't be letting her have marriage problems, I thought. They aren't even a year in, and I refuse to stop showing people that pizza picture. What's the pizza pic? What's the pizza pic? Oh, only my favorite pic of Ash of all time. Picture this. It's the end of her wedding night, and while the wedding party is bouncing back to the hotel on a party bus, singing along to Ignition Remix, as one does, I come up with the genius idea of going online and ordering from the local Little Caesars so that it'd be delivered as soon as we arrived. I initially was going to keep this plan on the down low so everyone would, marvel at my brilliance and be jealous of my piping hot crazy bread. But if there's one thing I love more than stuffing my gullet full of food when I'm drunk, it's telling people when I have a great idea. So what was supposed to be me breezing through the lobby and grabbing my bounty, like a marathon runner taking a cup of water without stopping, became a wedding party pileup with everyone waiting for their orders. And while Ash and her hubs would have normally headed straight to the penthouse suite for wedding night bliss, Ash was distracted by the smell. She was more concerned with consuming pizza than consummating her marriage, much to the dismay of her hubs. She plopped her beautiful white gown down in a seat and refused to go upstairs until she got some. For a second, I thought a hot slice of cheese was going to get the marriage annulled. As you can see by this picture included, she was all up in that pizza slice. And directly behind her, yeah, that's the legs of her fresh husband, who was already sick of her shit. I still laugh every time I see that pic. But there in that Sonoma restaurant, seeing Ashley with tears welling in her eyes, I was not laughing. Finally, she broke down. "I'm so exhausted. Jeff and I have been trying everything, and we just can't get pregnant. We're losing hope," she said, salty tears falling into salty chips. I thought, maybe if I planned a trip that was specifically for drinking, I would end up getting pregnant just out of irony. My heart sunk. Here she seemed to be effortlessly running the show, when secretly, she was stressed as all get out. Lindsay and I rubbed her back and listened to her unload everything she'd been feeling the past year, her stopping every few minutes to apologize to us for crying. The fertility methods, the close calls, the laborious adoption application process, how she'd been trying to keep it together while watching all her friends get pregnant so easily, not bringing it up as to not rain on their parades. No wonder she was stressed. Something struck me while I sat there on that bar stool. For the first half of our friendship, it would have been our worst nightmare to see two lines on a pregnancy strip. Now for her, it was the opposite. Gone were the days when the word pregnancy was followed up by scare. Ashley was the kindest, most nurturing person I knew. Whether that was babies or taking care of a drunk Mamrie after a field party, motherhood suited her. And now the only scare was that it wasn't going to happen naturally, like she'd imagined. In that moment, I finally felt what it meant to be in a real adult friendship. Back when we were teenagers, our biggest problems being our high school boyfriends not calling us when we clearly sent 911 to their pagers, or figuring out whose older brother was going to buy us a handle of pop-off for the weekend. Most of the time, I still feel like a teenager pretending to be an adult, like the movie Big, except instead of saying to Zoltar, "I wish I were big," I say to him, "I wish I was a dress size smaller." But sitting in that restaurant, I was weighed down with the reality of growing up. A few more margaritas and a lot of tears later, we trekked back to the hotel to pass out. I said goodnight to Ash, told her I loved her, and closed my eyes, agitated that I couldn't fix anything. It's not like when your friend gets dumped and you go, "They didn't deserve you. You're going to find someone better." And then you take them out on the town to get their mind off it and hopefully get them to make out with a stranger on a seedy dance floor. Nope. You can't go, "That unfertilized egg doesn't deserve you. Now go put your tongue in someone's mouth to the pulsing beats of Pitbull." All you can do is listen. When we all met in the lobby the next morning, it was the open door crew that looked bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Meanwhile, the Boomville gals were wearing floppy hats a little lower as to shade our bloodshot eyes. "Well, there y'all are," one of them called to us, to go cups of coffee in hand. "Sorry we slept through dinner last night. We must have just went down for a nap and never recovered." "Y'all didn't recover? And you weren't covered at all," I said, pouring myself the dregs of the remaining coffee. "Nice ass, by the way, Heather. What do we miss?" Ash and Lindsay and I all exchanged a quick look, but I spoke first. "Oh, nothing. We just went for a super chill dinner, came back, and were asleep before midnight." I grabbed Ash's hand and gave it a little squeeze. "Is anyone else starving, by the way?" "Not us," Heather spoke up between drags of her morning parliament light. "We ended up eating Mexican food."
"What the hell?"
Had they been at the restaurant and we were too busy crying and yammering that we hadn't seen them? "Yeah, we woke up at midnight starving and called an Uber to take us through Taco Bell drive-thru. Look, you can take the girls out of the white trash, but they're still gonna stink." "I am kidding, Heather et al. Y'all are not white trash. You aren't even that redneck. Ashley and I went through a phase where we smoked Doral's, okay? That's some redneck right there." We spent our last day together dragging, but staying on the planned itinerary, feeling like tiny fairies beside the giant trees of Muir Woods, and getting a waterfront lunch in Sausalito. Before heading to the airport and flying our separate ways home, I took Ash aside to let her know to reach out if she needed to talk, not to bury it all inside. She agreed. Plus, as an upside, I knew she was coming to L.A. 2 months later for work, so I'd have a chance to cheer her up then. 2 months later, and Ash was in Hollyweird. At that point, I was deep into production of Dirty 30, which was perfect. She was going to get to see me in action, acting in scenes, sitting with headphones on in the producer's chair, demanding that craft service make more vegan Southwest egg rolls. Once we were wrapped for the night, Ash and I bolted to my friend Jocelyn's book release party. I was so happy she was getting this full experience of seeing me do my L.A. thing. Plus, I could introduce her to some of my friends before inevitably cornering her to pick up where we'd left off on the baby convo, this time without the haze of all-day day drinking. We got to the party and it was packed. After hugging Jocelyn and taking a few pics in the adorable DIY photo booth, Ash and I moseyed up to the bar. It had been a long day on set and Mama needed a stiff one. "I think it's a vodka soda night for me. I need to wake up clear-headed. What are you having, Ash?" I looked back at my girl as a smile slowly spread across her face. "I'll take one too, but hold the vodka." At this point, the woman was beaming. "It's too early to tell people, but Jeff and I found out a couple weeks ago. I'm pregnant." There it was! The happy reveal! I, of course, immediately started crying. We hugged for possibly too long in the middle of that party before breaking it up and socializing. I was so happy for her. It was possibly the first time I've ever been happy that a friend wasn't drinking with me at a party. It was a full circle, perfect ending. Until the next day, when Ash got food poisoning and had to stay in her hotel room so she could privately shit her brains out. In the words of a future mom of the year, bless her heart. Long-lasting friendships. I remember when I was first introduced to my dear friend Wine. I'll be honest, she didn't give me the best first impression. I was 10 years old and attending communion at my grandma's Episcopalian church in Panama City. Back in Boonville, where the county was still dry and people didn't eat bland food if they didn't have to, communion didn't have real wine and stale wafers. It was Welch's and Hawaiian potato bread, but not at Graham's church. I took a sip from the chalice, thinking I was about to have a cold, crisp grape juice crushed by Jesus himself's feet and nearly spat it back in the minister's face. It was warm, and in my kid brain, I thought it must have gone bad. A handful of years later, I would be back to the bottle, drinking pink Boone's Farm at a party, and I thought I had gone bad. Ass. Badass. Luckily, as an adult, I realized that calling Boone's Farm wine is like calling Olive Garden authentic Italian. And I am totally kidding to any Olive Garden exec who's listening to this. I love your establishment, and I will gladly take a lifetime supply of free breadsticks. Now I'm into the real stuff. The Cabs, and Merlots, and Pinots, and Syrahs. Remember that song from the 90s, Mambo No. 5, where Lou Bega lists all the girls he loves? The Monicas, the Ericas, the Ritas. Just change all those ladies' names to types of wine, and that is my anthem. A lot of people get intimidated by wine because there are so many different options. I get it. Sometimes when I'm supposed to pick out where to go for dinner, I'll have 30 tabs opened on my phone comparing menus until I eventually say fuck it and eat a bag of baby carrots. But there's no reason to be intimidated by wine. Wine is your friend. And just like how you would want to hang out with certain friends in certain circumstances, I'm going to give you a crash course on what wines to drink when. Let's start with the reds, because the phrase, let's start with the whites, sounds inherently racist. Cabernet. This is your ride or die bitch. Super dependable. Cabs are often full-bodied and can have fruity and peppery notes. She's easy to get along with, but can occasionally surprise you with a little kick, depending on the day. Go split a rack of ribs with this one, because you're going to need a belly base coat for a long night. Cabs are so easy to drink with, you'll definitely be calling a cab home. Merlot. Merlot gets a lot of shit for being a basic bitch, but basic is just another word for popular. And speaking as my high school self, there ain't nothing wrong with being popular. We are not living in the movie Cruel Intentions. Sometimes people are popular because they're just nice and get along with everyone. Same with Merlot. Pinot Noir. This is your skinny bitch friend. Not a ton of depth with this one. It's like when you hang out with a friend you know isn't going to have a convo with you about religion or politics. While hanging out with them can be fun, this is more of a let's get lunch friendship. Not necessarily a dinner date, especially because you know she's not going to want to share any fatty appetizers. Shiraz. Have you seen the movie Rough Night? Shiraz is basically Kate McKinnon's character. This is a spicy, earthy as hell wine that packs a punch. If it had a human job, it would be a doula. Like, super interesting to talk to for a while, but you don't want to be cornered by her for too long at a party. It's overwhelming. Chianti / Sangiovese. These bitches are Italian and bold as fuck. I'm talking the type who won't sit with her back facing to the door in case there's a hit on her. Best paired with Italian food, obs. Her flavors are loud and will usually wake me up with a solid headache the next morning. And now let's talk about some whites, shall we? These are the girls who are usually a touch lighter and sweeter. The types of gals you can cozy up to for a little daytime hair of the dog after a long night with your red friends. Chardonnay. Who invited the aunt to the party? I kid! Chardonnay is delicious, but it often has an oaky, buttery vibe. It's decadent. It's eccentric. Just like grabbing drinks with an older family member, you've really got to be in the mood for it. And even when you are enjoying it, you probably want to limit it to a glass or two. Sauvignon Blanc. With its tendency to be fruity and floral, consider this the flower crown of whites. A Coachella girl in a glass. While it's sweet and fun and great to hang out with on a hot day, there isn't a lot of depth to Sauv Blancs. They kind of all blend together, and personally, hanging out with them too much can give me a terrible headache. Pinot Grigio. You honestly cannot go wrong with Pinot Grigio. She's the friend you can bring to any party, any social circle, and she's gonna get along with everyone. Not because she's particularly interesting, but because she's completely inoffensive. She's the girl your high school boyfriend ends up marrying. And when you meet her for the first time, she's fine, very pleasant, but nothing really sticks out, which makes sense because he was a dud, and him dumping you before college was the equivalent of Neo dodging those bullets in the Matrix. A gift that I use every time my friend is being rejected by a dude, by the way. White Zinfandel. I'm not mad at a white Zin, but do I want to drink it? Hell no. The hue alone makes me immediately hungover. But I don't think it should have the bad rap that it does, not any more than rosé. I'm going to get real here, and a lot of you might not agree with me. Rosé is basically white Zinfandel with a classier name and a lot more adorable t-shirts made in honor of it. There are so many rosé all day tote bags, but no Zin for the win when I can't tell the damn difference between the two. Rosé is like that friend who's always been a little trashy and self-deprecating, but now she has a British boyfriend and she's somehow cultured. Like how Lindsay Lohan all of a sudden has a weird European accent now, when you know that bitch is from Long Island. That said, hand me a glass of sparkling rosé, and I will immediately act like I'm on a yacht in Monte Carlo and forbid anyone to make eye contact with me. And just like friendships, may I suggest trying all of these on for size? What you got along with in your 20s might not be your ideal pairing in your 30s. People evolve, and so do their tastes. And holy hell, if that is not a perfect segue into the next chapter, one that you might want to pour a glass of your favorite friend to have on standby, I don't know what is. singled out. Whether you know me from the internet, or from my first book, or from my mother convincing you to buy this thing at your last choir rehearsal, shout out to the alto section of Boonville United Methodist Church, you know that I am pretty private when it comes to my love life. Will I tell you at the drop of a dime the inner details of my last colonic? Of course I will. But have I ever mentioned who I'm dating on a public forum? Nope, never. But I figured this is my second book. I should dig a little deeper, which is also what I told the person administering my last colonic. Hey-o! Can you tell that I get so uncomfortable opening up this side of me that I feel the need to ease you in with terrible garbage humor? I mean it. This is all new for me. But fuck it. I want to share my experiences, and I already cashed my book advance, so let's do this. March of 2016 found me in a position that I had never been in before. The flying reverse scorpion from page 87 of the Kama Sutra. Kidding! I wish! I was basically in the opposite position. I was single and couldn't have been further from physical contact with a male specimen. You might be thinking, but Mamrie, we've all been through a breakup. Big whoop. Deal with it. Now, before you get up on your high horse, let's get one thing out of the way. This was no ordinary breakup. This wasn't one of those, we fell in love, it was amazing for a couple years, then he shattered my heart, and now I need to buy stock in Ben & Jerry's because I am solely keeping them in business type of situations. This was a major life event, because he and I had dated for more than 10 years, and yet there was no earth-shattering event that caused the breakup. We simply drifted apart, and it was devastating to finally realize that. When I met my ex, I was about 9 months out of college and living in New York. Having gone to a college where most of the women were blonde, bouncy rich girls, I shockingly never had a boyfriend. I was the girl you brought to your frat formal because I'd bring weed and have a shot-taking contest with the biggest bro, but I wasn't the girl you'd introduce to your parents on alumni weekend. It wasn't that I went on dates and they were bad. It was just after a few years of not being pursued, I kind of friend-zoned myself. So when I met my ex about a year into living in New York City, it was just the same. He had a girlfriend at the time, so a relationship was off the table, and we just became summer drinking buddies while our other friends had to keep responsible schedules. Perpetual friend zone. Huh. A place I knew well. So when one night when he told me he was breaking up with his girlfriend, I was thrown off. I realized I have feelings for you, he told me at Bull McCabe's, a dark East Village bar where we would sit outside and drink beers all night as he smoked cigarettes and I blocked out the constant current of rats rolling by. I was in shock. Had I been suppressing a latent crush on my friend? Of course I had. But I didn't think anything would happen. I sat there sipping my Corona as he continued. So I'm going to break up with her tomorrow. It's not fair for me to have these feelings and be in it. Even if you don't feel the same. I feel the same way, I said. And that was it. I had a boyfriend. And for the next 10 years, it was the smoothest of sailing. We'd become friends first, before any of the romantic stuff. Friendship led our relationship. I was accepted and loved and content. I was also grateful to be off the meat market. With my personal life on lock, I didn't have that distraction. I dove headfirst into work with blinders on. I knew I could be completely selfish in the amount of effort it takes in this weird industry and still have someone being my cheerleader without being jaded about it. Plus, dating seemed horrible. All the games, all the rules. My girlfriends would bitch to me over cocktails about their latest dating fiasco while I'd sit there, nodding my head in solidarity, before going home to my super stable partner. Thank God I don't have to deal with that, I'd think, as they'd tell me about another teenage idiot trapped in a grown man's body. Isn't it so great I got to hit fast forward and skip all that bullshit? Isn't it? The truth is, over time, I wasn't so sure. Don't get me wrong. Our relationship was filled with the hardest of laughs and being our truest silly selves together. But after I turned 30, the teeniest, tiniest sliver in the back of my brain started to feel like I was somehow missing out on crucial life experiences by being in a committed relationship. I'd always heard people talking about how much they learned from every breakup, and I'd never really had one as an adult. I started to become obsessed with that idea. Was not having experienced heartache in some way stunting my development as a full-fledged person? In our 10-plus years together, I never had to deal with sadness. Our relationship was stable and supportive and fun and even tempered, so much so that when I realized I might want to end it, it seemed unfathomable. In what world would someone end a relationship where there are zero fights, zero arguments? But therein lies the rub. Without those peaks and valleys, you can step back and see a flat line. We were best friends and great roommates and each other's cheerleaders, but we weren't in a true romantic relationship anymore. We both knew it, even if we didn't want to admit it. There was an elephant in the room, an elephant who'd been hanging out in our living room for years, chilling and eating all our snacks and not even apologizing for it. I knew that elephant was there because the couch had gradually become my nightly bed, and that elephant was on the floor snoring, keeping me up at night. I tried to convince myself that everything was fine. Our relationship was fine. And maybe if I just made some positive changes for myself, it would have a domino effect on the relationship. Maybe if I felt more attractive, I'd be more inclined to get physical with my partner. So I hightailed it to the gym. I lost a shitload of weight. I dyed my hair darker. I bought the dream car I always wanted. And in doing that, I saw myself starting to self-actualize into the person I would want to be if I was single. It was like when a dog goes into the woods alone because it knows it's going to die. Only instead of heading into the wilderness, I started getting on the treadmill every day, pumping that incline to the highest degree like I was hiking away from my problems. But no matter how good my ass was looking from all that steep walking, my head and heart were in the same place. I eventually stood still and confronted my feelings, which felt like an impossible task. He had done nothing but been loving and supportive and wonderful. So how do you say you don't want it anymore? It's like ordering something at a restaurant, and when it comes out completely like you asked for, exactly how it sounded on the menu, you end up saying, "Nah, I think I'd just rather starve for a little bit. It looks great, though." Sending that first, "Hey, we need to talk tonight," text set everything in motion. My heart was breaking, my stomach was aching, and I felt like I was living in an alternate universe, one in which I would no doubt be the bad guy, the villain who also feels unbelievable amounts of guilt. Maybe this was my fault completely. Maybe I was the one who leaned too much on the friendship, and he just followed my lead. Had I concentrated on my career too much? Maybe this was my Achilles heel. My obsessive drive and work would always be my mistress, and I worried that eventually my partner would become tired of being a third wheel. Even if that wasn't the case, I still needed to know what it was like to be by myself. I drove home, hands shaking, wondering if I'd have the balls to start the conversation. When you're ending a relationship of that length and without a true inciting incident or drama, there's no such thing as ripping it off like a Band-Aid. It's a lot more drawn out and painful than that. More like slowly peeling off the strips of duct tape you used in lieu of a bra to keep your tits up in a deep plunging dress, which I have zero shame in admitting that is my favorite red carpet beauty trick. The next 2 weeks were a slow burn of breakup conversations, of terrible moments crying together on our couch, and then one of us saying something to lighten the mood. "I'm gonna get super ripped now, you know that, right?" he said to me at one point, making me laugh as I wiped away tears. "I mean it. I am going to be so in shape. I'm starting my own YouTube channel tomorrow." Him making me laugh in that moment made me love him more than ever. But deep down, it also told me I was making the right move. My love was now one of friendship and history and respect, but I needed more, or to at least try for more. But it was scary. To put it in perspective, I hadn't been single since I was fresh out of college. The last time I ever brought a new guy home, I was a naive New York City newbie living in an empty apartment in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn. My only possessions in my room were a suitcase full of clothes and an air mattress that had a hole in it. And for months, I was too broke to buy a new one, so I would just fold the flaccid plastic mattress in half to pad the wood floor a little more. This was totally different. I wouldn't be out on the dating scene drinking PBRs and counting my ones to see if I could afford a cab home if the date went awry. I was a grown woman. This wasn't going to be girls. This would be Sex in the City. Though a couple seasons in when Carrie wasn't such a mess. Bring on the cosmos! Because the breakup was my choice, I decided I would be the one to move out and find a new place. Being on my own was going to be a totally new experience for me. I lived with my mom and siblings until college, then had roommates in my dorm, then roommates for a year in New York, then I moved in with my ex. Finally, I was going to experience full freedom. Knowing that if there were dishes in the sink, I couldn't be frustrated that someone else had left them, or wait for someone else to clean them like a dirty sink standoff. Having a fridge full of things I loved eating, without having to block out the mayonnaise or other ungodly white condiments. What would my aesthetic be like? I'd always decorated how I liked, but with my partner's style in mind. Would I be super minimalist and modern now? Or would I go the opposite route and start scouring eBay for one of those lip couches from MTV Singled Out? Fuck it! If I'm going for a big lip couch, I might as well install my own champagne glass tub! First things first, I had to actually find a place. I scoured Craigslist and found an adorable house for rent, and with fingers crossed that it wouldn't be a murderer's den in real life, I made an appointment to see it. Craigslist can be hit or miss. When I lived in New York City, I'd go look at apartments that looked like a penthouse suite in the photos, but were as sketchy as a penthouse magazine when I got there. So I knew it was a gamble, but by some grace of God damn luck, this place looked exactly like it did online. It was perfect. A sunny one-bedroom in a walkable neighborhood that I loved. Plus, there was a yard that my dog Beans could sunbathe in. And there was a hot tub. It was a no-brainer. But just like any new ramen restaurant, once something is good, there's inevitably a line for it. Hey, I know you're showing your house to lots of people, I said to the married landlords as the next folks waited in the front yard to be shown the place, their maniac toddler running and yapping like one of those wind-up toy dogs that can do backflips. But wouldn't it be nice to rent it to a single, mature woman in her 30s who travels a lot? Instead of some starter family that has kids who will definitely trash the place? I mean, kids are a nightmare. I turned to the pregnant wife. No offense. This was our actual interaction. And they actually chose me. I moved in a few weeks later, walking up to the front door with a rolling suitcase full of clothes in one hand and a rolled-up air mattress that Jocelyn had loaned me in the other. As I plopped down in the empty living room, I daydreamed about how I'd fill up the room with cool art and furniture. I couldn't stop smiling at the potential of what this life and house would look like a few months down the road. The sun set, and I was about to have my first evening living by myself. I sat on the kitchen counter bar stools, sipping on a vodka soda, just relaxing in the moment. It was so peaceful. So quiet. So quiet. Jesus Christ, why is it so quiet? If there was ever a moment to cue, "Hello, darkness, my old friend," it was then. I started feeling anxious. It was total immersive silence. I had previously lived in neighborhoods with lots of traffic, but this house was on a quaint residential street. My just-off-the-highway apartment in Brooklyn would make this place feel like a sensory deprivation tank in comparison. I didn't even have a TV hooked up yet to distract myself. But it wasn't just a noisy neighborhood that was missing. It was the noise inside. The noise that comes from living with another person. Someone to talk to, or make quips during Shark Tank to, or yell to bring you a towel when you got in the shower without one on standby. Another brain in the house to bounce an idea off of, or someone who could band together with you to fight off an intruder. Even the simple concept of not having another opinion on what to cook for dinner, to not have an I cook if you do the dishes trade-off, was mind-blowing. For the past 10 years, there had been an alley-oop aspect to everything in my home life. And now I felt like I was tossing a ball towards the basket, only for it to bounce right back down with a thud. I felt like I was having an awkward lulling conversation with myself. So while my anxiety just kept dialing up and up, I decided to crank something else that night. Music. Screw that Sound of Silence bullshit. I blasted some good old Sean Paul on my phone and danced in front of my new floor-length mirror closet doors until I was drunk and dripping in sweat. If this visual seems kind of sad to you, don't worry. I had an audience. And by that, I mean I woke up Beans, who'd been sleeping under the throw blanket on the air mattress, to watch my moves. She was unimpressed, which is rude, considering how hard I was working it. I was dancing on a level that while you're doing it, you can already predict how sore your thighs are going to be the next day. Eventually, all the cocktails and aerobic ass-shaking caught up with me, and I was ready to call it a night. My first sleep in my new place. I turned off the lights and slowly pushed Beans over to one side. I tell you, for being 5 pounds, the dog somehow hogs the bed. It doesn't matter if we're sharing a couch or a California king. It's like the genes from the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. Somehow, her body adapts and she takes up 75% of any sleeping space. So, I got her bobbed to one side and snuggled in under the throw. This isn't so bad, I thought to myself as I stared up at the ceiling. I'm gonna be just fine in this silence. But it was at that exact moment when I heard the tiniest high-pitched noise, like the lightest dog whistle, or when Pee Wee Herman would do that routine of slowly letting the air out of a balloon. And that's when I knew. Son of a bitch. This air mattress had a hole in it. I shook my head in disbelief as I felt the mattress below me slowly starting to lose its firmness, like an overhandled peach. There I was, 10 years since moving to New York, 10 years older, 10 years wiser, and yet I still found myself in an empty place by myself on a deflating air mattress. I couldn't tell if this was sad or not. It felt very full circle, but maybe full circle isn't a good thing since it means you end up where you started. Maybe these past 10 years had just been a giant lap, and I was back at the starting line once again. My mind raced. Is this just who I was when I was on my own? A girl who sleeps on deflated air mattresses? My ex would never have been in this position. He would have blown up the mattress and made sure it was okay way earlier in the day, not when he was too drunk to drive anywhere to get a new one. Is this air mattress some sort of metaphor for not being able to take care of myself? I thought as my body slowly descended to the hardwood floor. But rather than wallow in self-pity, I popped up off the deflating raft and decided to take action. I wasn't the same naive girl I'd been back in Brooklyn. I was a woman now, an independent, successful woman. I didn't need someone to take care of me. What I needed was to solve this myself, to get my act together, and to pay someone to deliver me some duct tape to patch up this damn hole. Seriously, I went on a delivery service app and paid $20 to have a $3 roll of duct tape delivered. I swear this isn't for anything weird or sexual, I tried to tell Patrice, the very judgy-looking older lady who handed me the duct tape from her car window. Mm-hmm, she mumbled under her breath before speeding off. But did I care? Hell no. Did the duct tape fix the hole completely? Of course not. I woke up a few hours later on a half-deflated air mattress with beans on top of me, scared I was going to roll over in my sleep and catapult her into the air like she was on one of those inflatable blobs people have off lake docks. It didn't matter that my back was killing me, or that I was already hungover and it was only 5 a.m. I was proud of myself. I had stuck out the silence. I wasn't that 22-year-old in Brooklyn anymore, ignoring the discomfort of a broken bed. I was ready to fix my problems when I spotted them, not just deal with discomfort because it seemed more comfortable than confronting it. From the cradle of that plastic taco I was in, I got on my phone and ordered a real bed frame and a real mattress. My first home purchase. The only catch was that it was going to be a solid 6 weeks before they were delivered, but that was okay by me because I had some traveling to do. I think I can. Disclaimer. Feel free to take a moment to go online and download the sad trombone sound effect to play in response to this chapter title. Not impressed? I almost named this one Eiffel Crazy. Every so often, I get asked to speak on a panel about the digital world or being a female writer or what have you. It's such a perk. I've done them so often that sometimes I feel like a parakeet who's only learned the words authenticity and my brand. Other times, everyone else on the panel is so eloquent and smart that I feel like a Beverly Hillbilly doing their first interview. So why do I do them? Easy. Because if I really get going, I can make myself cringe, and cringing is great for your abs. Also, because you can't spell panel without plane, a.k.a. the panel is in a really cool spot and they cover your travel. And no free trip has ever felt more glamorous than when I was asked to do a panel in, drumroll please, Cannes. Yes, that Cannes. The type of place that is so storied, so mythical, it sounds fake, like Ibiza or Bora Bora. Why was such a classy place letting a creature like me in? Ironically, because I had been a creature earlier that year. Several months prior, I had been lucky enough to be involved in a web series called Oscar's Hotel for Fantastical Creatures. In it, I got to do something I've always dreamed about. Become a Jim Henson creature. As a girl who was obsessed with Fraggle Rock and Labyrinth and the Muppets growing up, it was an incredible experience. But as a girl who can occasionally get herself worked into a panic attack when she feels claustrophobic, being glued into a giant octopus costume for 4 hour stretches at a time was not so amazing. Somehow I made it. Here's a picture of me as Octochef. Go check out the picture of me as Octochef. Yep, I did not operate that entire costume myself. There were actually 4 men underneath me moving the tentacles. 4 men underneath me. I felt right at home. At this point, it had been a couple months since my breakup. For those first few, the grieving and guilt from ending it were omnipresent. Everything reminded me of it. Goes to a bar. Oh, my ex and I used to go to this bar. I hope he's doing okay. Eats a taco. Oh, my ex loved him some tacos. I hope he's doing okay. Sees a bird. My ex loved bird watching. I hope he's doing okay. Not having a partner in crime was a new reality for me, especially with texting. You don't realize how much you can text someone all day, like a stream of consciousness, until you don't. When I was out at night, I'd feel something nagging at me, like I'd forgotten to do something, until I'd have to remember that, no, you don't have to text anyone your whereabouts or what time you'll be home. When I started daydreaming about what I wanted for dinner, I had to remind myself that it was just my choice. There was no one to text and ask, what you hankering for tonight? It's just me. And those first couple of months were tough. Where I would normally text a thought, I now just had the thought and swallowed it. But slowly, that feeling of free-falling began to feel normal. Empowering, even. I didn't feel alone so much as I felt independent. I was an untethered balloon, no longer tied to someone's wrist, and I was ready to fly, baby. Specifically, first class to Cannes. Apparently, every year there's this huge convention called MIPCOM in the south of France, or MIP for short. The production company that produced Oscar's Hotel was attending, and they asked me to join them. My excited brain was flooded with thoughts when they made me the offer. They came in as follows. 1. VIP to MIP? That's quite the trip. 2. What the hell is MIP? And 3. What do they want in exchange? It turns out that MIPCON was a place where people took their projects to be sold in international markets. And so the Jim Henson team was trying to sell the overseas rights to the show. All I was obligated to do during my time there was participate in a 5-minute interview on stage in front of buyers, talking up the production company and project, and then I was done working. So, of course, my answer to them was an enthusiastic, fuck yeah. This was a dream come true and exactly what I needed at the moment. I had wanted to go to France since I'd read all the Madeleine books as a little girl. Hello, an outgoing, outspoken redhead who's constantly getting into adventures? That bitch sounds familiar. I dreamed about seeing the Eiffel Tower and spending my morning eating pain au chocolat, which sounded so much nicer than croissant with chocolate shoved in it. I wanted to wander the narrow streets drinking lattes, watching the sunset over the Seine, and then spend my evenings watching the dancers at Moulin Rouge. I knew I had to seize this opportunity, so I not only said yes to the trip, but I asked them to fly me out of Paris so I could spend some time there. They agreed, so the plan was for me to be in Cannes for MIP for a few days, then take a train to Paris, where I would gallivant around and no doubt be mistaken for the grown-up version of Madeleine by tourists. As the weeks passed, my excitement built, which helped push any other feelings of sadness or weirdness onto the back burner. I daydreamed about my adventures there, dining al fresco at one of those tiny cafes, observing the beautiful people around me sharing midday bottles of wine, munching on baguettes. I imagined myself skipping down the streets, wearing striped shirts and a little red scarf around my neck, saying, bonjour, bonjour, like the heroine of my own indie movie. And deep down, I had to admit, I didn't just want to feel French on my trip. I wanted to be French. While I had come out of my breakup assuming I'd be a wild woman, months later, I still hadn't kissed anyone. If I was being honest, this urge to put my mouth on a new person scared me. What if my first kiss in a decade was bad? I was pretty out of practice, but I had to start somewhere, I decided, and what better place to do that than Paris? My thoughts swirled. Hooking up with some handsome international businessman along the French Riviera wouldn't just be getting back on the horse. It would be straight up sprinting like a U.S. gymnast, ricocheting off the catapult and doing a 720-degree spin only to stick the landing on that dick! If I couldn't get kissed in a week in France, then I might as well join a convent and take a vow of celibacy. I immediately went shopping for my France wardrobe. Bye-bye, acid-washed shorts, and asked who else would be coming on the trip. First, there was Jarrett. Jarrett is a handsome, hilarious, sweet, and sensitive jujitsu-loving actor-creator. The kind of person who is as down to do a 40-minute bit in a fake British accent as he is to have a deep, hours-long conversation about how the brain processes love. We'd been around each other in small doses and always enjoyed each other's company, but we never hung out in a long stretch like this. Then there was Tony. Ugh. Tony was Jared's creative partner and just a magical elf of a human. Not because he was small or anything, he was a normal-sized man, with bleached blonde hair and a big smile, but he had this Seuss-ish way with words and made him a delight to be around. Rounding out the crew was Serena. Now, I had never met Serena before, but we did have mutual friends in common, and once we had spoken for 5 minutes, it felt like I'd known her forever. Serena was whip-smart and not afraid to make fun of herself, and she goes into a hilarious fake Bronx accent once she's had a few drinks. It was the perfect mishmash of different personalities who shared the same level of silliness. It was also the perfect mix of people I was comfortable with, but not super close to, which was crucial. No one was going to try to do an hour-long interview with me about my breakup, which had been happening left and right with other friends. I mean, I get it. People are always curious as to why couples call it off, especially after so many years, but hot damn! With some friends, it felt like there was a single light bulb swinging over my head as they interrogated me about the details, as if they were going to crack some case and find out that I cheated or something. I was over talking about it. I landed in Cannes with a suitcase of outfits that said, "Wee wee, I'm French," and an inflated ego from flying first class. We were staying at the Carlton, where all the stars stay during the film festival. I don't know if I have ever felt more like Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman when I rolled up in there. The room was beautiful. The ceilings were high, and the prices on the minibar were even higher. But they didn't have my credit card on file. So I sat on my grandiose bed and took those 15-euro cashews to the face. A few snacks later, and I heard the sound of a WhatsApp message coming through on my phone. It was from Jarrett. Anybody down for a drink in the lobby bar? I could use a mip or two. And so began the constant punning up of the convention's name as we sat in that fancy-ass lobby drinking Negronis. For example, man, this really is the mip of a lifetime. You guys, please don't drink too much and fall tonight. We don't need anyone to have a mip slip. I came to this convention before it was popular. One could say I'm a mipster. Are we actually in the south of France right now, or am I mipping my balls off? I just want to make sure we do this thing right. One might say, I want to mip it. Mip it good. What a long, strange mip it's been. Serena, we already used the trip as mip pun. Wake up, Mip Van Winkle. Yeah, Mamrie, mip her a new one. There's something special about a group getting to know one another so far removed from their normal lives. It takes everyone out of their element, out of talking about the minutiae of their own lives, and instead just lets them focus on what's happening in the present. By the end of the first day, we had a million inside jokes and callbacks between us, mainly of mip puns and how bad Serena was at them. When it came time to actually go to the convention, the laughing hit an all-time peak, thanks to some of the other projects that were trying to be sold. Things like police beauties and police dogs out of Japan. You know, just your classic show of beautiful police women and their, in my opinion, equally beautiful dogs. But my overall favorite was a romantic film out of China. I can't remember the title, but the logline will forever be emblazoned in my brain and heart. Here goes. Sometimes love is sweet like a salty rose. Sometimes it's sweet like candies. And sometimes it's so spicy that it makes your eyes watery. Nothing, and I mean nothing, makes me laugh harder than bad translations. In my early Brooklyn days, I would scour dollar stores to try to find the best birthday cards with nonsensical translations. Things like, birthday happy times party kitties, and hope your birthday is smile trees and sunshine hugs. But this poem? This was art. I immediately memorized it and said it over and over again throughout the day. The panel was as expected, a room full of suits staring at us as we gushed about how great it was to work with a production company. I'm pretty sure I only used the word authenticity twice. But to be fair, I was only on stage for 4 minutes. Yes, these people flew us out to be on stage for 4 minutes. Hollywood is insane. That night, I got so blackout drunk, hi, recently single girl, that I kept repeating my new favorite Salty Rose poem like a broken record at the bar we closed down. This is also where I asked the DJ to play A Tribe Called Quest, and when he told me no, I flipped him off. Again, I'm not sure why they let me come to this classy place. I was in bad shape, guys. Every 5 minutes, I fell down like a 5-minute-old deer. Flats or sneakers couldn't be a part of my classy French wardrobe. No, no. I insisted on bringing the tallest heels to Cannes, which means my drunk ass is racking up new bruises left and right. Serena, bless her heart, tried to get me to just relinquish control and let her and Jarrett carry me home like a town drunk. Mamrie, just get in between us and put your arms on our shoulders, Serena said. You can be the cream to our Oreo. That's pretty sweet, don't you think? Well, I didn't. According to Serena, when she recounted this the next day, as soon as she dropped the Oreo analogy, I whipped my head around, looked her dead in the eye, and said, "Stop being condescending to me." Somehow, we are still friends. The next morning, my head felt like I'd pulled a Mario Brothers and just spent the evening breaking bricks with my head. I was embarrassed and not quite even sure of my actions from the night before, so I did what anyone would do. I blocked it out and pretended nothing weird happened so as not to ruin the vibe of the trip. "I can't believe we just have one more day here," Jarrett said, as we waited for our round of double espressos in the lobby. "I know," Tony chimed in, chipper as fuck, because he's one of those rare creatures that doesn't have to drink to have a good time. "I don't want to go back yet." "Then don't," I said with a smirk on my face. These were my kind of people. People who weren't calling out my drunk-ass shenanigans in the harsh daylight. and I knew they would be up for more adventures. Come to Paris with me. I'll bet they'll change your flight, and then we can all get an Airbnb together. I didn't even have to look up for my coffee. I knew the guys were in. Sadly, Serena had to get back to L.A. and couldn't join us. 24 hours later, and we were riding a train to Paris, hugging the coastline for the first few hours, then weaving our way through the French countryside. We couldn't get our seats together, but that was fine because my seatmate was a tiny old lady who was already asleep, her eyes shaded by Chanel sunglasses rimmed in pearls. As someone who once took an overnight Greyhound trip sitting beside a woman who used her stomach as a TV tray to eat a giant container of General Tso's chicken, I was happy as a clam. Specifically a geoduck clam, which basically looks like a massive penis, but you can save that Google image search until after this chapter. Once our train arrived, we hopped in an Uber to go check out our apartment. The car pulled up to a beautiful building with a metal gate, and after a few minutes of figuring out the lock, the three of us crammed into a teensy tiny elevator headed up to the fifth floor. When I say teensy, I mean it. This felt more like one of those shoots at a drive-thru bank teller than a real Vader. The apartment itself was massive and old and gorgeous, with its Louis the, some numerical number, remake furniture and Juliet balconies at every window. And I stress the word balconies because it's a stretch calling those things balconies. I don't know how skinny Juliet was, but I could barely get half of myself out there. Anybody else just want to sit in cafes all day and drink rosé and eat pommes frites? Jared asked. Oh, you mean some French fries and pink wine? I asked in my thickest Yadkin County, North Carolina accent. It almost felt blasphemous in such a beautiful space. Actually, I think I'm going to go explore the city, see le sights, Tony said in a thick French accent while lounging on a gaudy gold couch. Tony, God love him, is one of those people who immediately assumes the accent of wherever he is. I know this well. It's very common among actors, or more embarrassingly, my mom. A theater grad herself and a wonderful actress, the second my mom hears a foreign accent, I can see her eyes go big and her lips start to move, practicing the dialect in her head. She can't help it. When I was in high school and she was working two jobs to keep us afloat, teaching high school English and theater by day and bartending at night, she told me that she would sometimes speak to her customers in a Scottish accent just because she was bored. And it always got her better tips. While Tony set off to hit up Le Landmarks, Jer and I started walking through the neighborhoods to double down on that cafe culture. We couldn't believe our eyes. It was like we were walking through a set. Like, at any moment, we could push on one of the baguette and bouquet-filled storefronts, only for it to fall over and reveal some stagehands on a smoke break. We skipped through the streets, popping into tiny cafe after tiny cafe to have a little wine and watch the passersby. It started raining, which is normally a downer when you're exploring, but somehow it only made the city more charming. Whenever the rain would let up, we'd gallivant to another hole in the wall, relishing in the insanely good wine and perfectly crisp pommes frites. It was the most picturesque, classy bar crawl imaginable. After a few burgundies, we became a teensy bit less self-aware and were no longer whispering but exclaiming, "That's so French!" whenever we saw something, well, super fucking French. By our fifth cafe, we were both pretty lit. Conversations started to turn from light stuff to deep real-life talk. Everything from career choices to family to past relationships, and wouldn't you know it, the circumstances surrounding my breakup. Truth be told, I hadn't had a real conversation about the breakup with anyone except my super close girlfriends. It was the first time I was explaining the situation to someone who didn't know the history of our relationship. As I sipped my $5 glass of Bordeaux that would have been $20 back home, I started to really open up. The thing is, no one fucked up. There wasn't any drama. And sometimes life needs a little drama. We just become passing ships, I said, tears starting to well up in my eyes. I genuinely, truly, honestly just want him to be happy, and I don't think I was that person for him in the long run. Luckily, before I could have a full-on breakdown over our baguette, a man smoking a cigarette while walking a French bulldog walked by. "That's so French!" we screamed in unison, much to the chagrin of every couple there trying to get their romance on. "Do you think they just call French bulldogs bulldogs since we're in France?" Jared asked. I was happy he'd changed the subject. We settled our check and continued on our path down the moonlit streets yelling, "That's so French!" Were we being obnoxious Americans? Absolutely. Would we have maybe run through a brick wall Kool-Aid Man style if we had seen a mime? Lord, yes. But we were having a fun and magical night, one that I really needed. I had kept myself so busy in my own memory universe that it wasn't until that night when I realized how much I hadn't dealt with my breakup.